I know that you currently live in Arkansas.
Correct.
But you have been involved with the Virginia Council on Indians in the past. Is that correct?
And that is correct.
What did you do for the Virginia Council on Indians? Can you tell us a little about that organization?
The Virginia Council on Indians was established in 1983, I believe it was, when six of the eight tribes in the Commonwealth were granted state recognition by the Commonwealth. And the Commission on Indians, which became the Council on Indians, said that there would be a council established that would have representation from each of the tribes, and then some members at large, and then members of the state legislature. And then those together would, you know, provide some guidance for the state government. There would be some representation, a voice for the Indian people. And that voice was going to come from all of these Indian representatives who in turn were getting guidance from their own tribal leadership. You know, you never want to misspeak. And you never want to say that you're speaking on behalf of everyone. Because you, Danielle, do not speak on behalf of every woman that exists.
Or the
College of William and Mary. Right. So it's very, very important when people are in these positions or in that role that you're doing it with the guidance of your own tribal leadership. It is, I just can't imagine being so disrespectful as to not seek the guidance of your own tribal leadership.
What kinds of initiatives did you work on when you were part of the council?
One of the big things involved the correction of the birth certificates in the Commonwealth of Virginia, as you know, based again once on the Racial Integrity Act of the Commonwealth. There were many birth certificates that had been altered once they were filed with the Commissioner of Vital Records.
And that is altered to remove Indian as a designation, is that
right.
correct?
Oh, I can tell you, like on Daddy's birth certificate, you know, we actually saw that, that you weren't to, of course we know with the Racial Integrity Act, you know, that Indian people were to be identified as colored. You know, because if you had one drop of non-white blood, you were considered colored. So it was white and colored. So on Daddy's birth certificate, I saw his that had been submitted with him being Indian. It was scratched through and colored was written over top of it. Well, when the person at the Bureau of Vital Records did that, they forgot to change his parents because his parents were still listed on there and they were still listed as Indian.
I see.
So that was one of the things that, I was part of.
That law stayed in effect until the U.S. Supreme Court overturned the racial integrity law. That wasn't overturned until 1968. How did that play out, this racial integrity law on the marriage of your parents?
I mentioned earlier that they couldn't attend schools in the Commonwealth of Virginia as Indian. They would have to have attended as colored. Same applied to the marriage certificates. Marriage certificates were only going to be issued as white or colored. Because of that, there were many couples in the Commonwealth of Virginia that went to Washington, D.C. and were married by the chaplain of Congress, where their marriage certificates could actually be issued as Indian, and that's what happened with my parents.
So your parents left Virginia,
yes,
to get married, so
correct,
they could get married under their actual identity,
correct,
as American Indians, and then came back into the Commonwealth. And I think some, the past few years before your father died, there was a special anniversary.
That's correct.
Event, isn't that right?
Yes. Mama and Daddy renewed their wedding vows on their 50th anniversary.
Here in Virginia.
And ironically, They were married on August 19th, 1950, and they renewed their vows on August 19th, 2000. So, very special day. And when they were married, Daddy's mother had gone with them, my grandmother. One of my uncles, one of my mother's brothers had gone. Chief Oliver Atkins had gone to Washington.
So part of the community went.
Exactly. Part of the community went. So the day that they renewed their vows, the only surviving member other than my mom and dad was one of my uncles, one of my mom's brothers, and he was part of the ceremony that day.
As I recall, it was for the Chickahominy tribe. It was a big anniversary.
Yes, and we invited everyone. Yes, had a reception. You know, as Mama said, she never had a big wedding, so this was her big wedding. And I was one of her attendants, as well as my sister-in-law and my niece. And then my older brother was my dad's best man.
What do you hope for your tribal community in the future? We're approaching 2007. There's a lot of attention on the 400th anniversary of Jamestown. How do you see that story? There's just a lot of various discussions about 2007 and what should be presented as the Indian story. Any thoughts on that?
Well, 2007 is made up of lots of stories. And the important thing is all of the accurate stories are portrayed, not only for the Indian people in the Commonwealth, but the English have always shared their side. And then later on you had, you know, the indentured servants that came to Virginia and served. So they have a story to tell as well. You know, I look at the opportunity that we as the Indian people are telling our own story, mm-hmm. not having someone tell it for us, unless we say, on our behalf, will you do this? But it is just very, very important that we tell that story and make people aware of the fact that we are still here. Since that contact in 1607, we very much are alive. We're very active in our communities, our churches, in governments. You know, that we just have not died off, as some would assume that we have. We have a very Western culture, if you will. You know, we own our own homes, we own cars, we pay taxes, you know, we do things that every other citizen of the Commonwealth does.
Your dad told me that part of that story, maybe that accurate story that's often missed, your dad said, we helped the English survive. Was that talked about in your community?
Yes, it was. Yes, it was. One of the things that I know the Chickahominy people were involved in. I'm sure there were other tribes as well, but the Chickahominy people helped the English survive that winter 1609. And had we not given them, you know, some of the food from our own storehouse, the food that we had raised and put in the community storehouse where we could survive for the winters, you know, no one was neglected. It wasn't the haves and the have-nots. You know, the crops, you know, the harvest, everything was shared by the entire community. So we took some of that harvest and shared with the English to help them survive that winter. And that, to me, is a very critical role. Historically, looking at our tribe and what is the expectation. We have a purpose. And we each tribe has a purpose, and each tribe needs to know what their purpose is and follow that purpose, because following the purpose helps fulfill the plan, whatever that plan is. And that, to me, is very critical.
Well, Lenora Atkins, I want to thank you for sharing so much with us today and talking with us about the Chickahominy history.
I appreciate the opportunity, you know. We have a great responsibility to educate, and educate properly. Through education, a lot of things will change. And I think some of the attitudes and some of the behaviors of those who don't know can be changed when we educate them.
Excellent. Thank you.